less than human. So Perry and I took the book, gathered up our few belongings, and fled Paris. He's been chasing us ever since. They stopped at a crosslight. A trio of British tourists was waiting for the light to change, and Flamel fell silent, a quick glance at Sophie and Josh warning them to say nothing. The light changed, and they crossed, the tourists heading to the right, Nicholas Flamel and the twins moving to the left.
"Where did you go when you left Paris?" Josh asked.
"London," Flamel said shortly. "D nearly caught us there in 1666, he continued. "He loosed a fire elemental after us, a savage, mindless creature that almost devoured the city. History calls it the Great Fire." Sophie looked over at Josh. They had both heard of the Great Fire of London. They had learned about it in world history. She was surprised by how calm she felt. Here she was, listening to a man who claimed to be more than 500 years old, recounting historical events as if he had been there when they happened. And she believed him. "Dee came dangerously close to capturing us in Paris in 1763, Flamel continued, "and again in 1835 when we were in Rome, working as booksellers, as it happens. That was always my favorite occupation," he added. He fell silent as they approached a group of Japanese tourists, listening intently to their guide, who was standing beneath a bright yellow umbrella. When they were out of earshot, he continued, the events of more than a century and a half earlier obviously still fresh and bitter in his memory. "We fled to Ireland, thinking he would never find us on that island at the edge of Europe. But he pursued us. He had managed to master the control of whites then, and brought two over with him, the disease white and the hunger white, no doubt intending to set them on our trail. At some point he lost control of the creatures. Hunger and disease ravaged that poor land. 1 million people died in Ireland's Great Famine in the 1840s. Nicholas Flamel's face hardened into a mask. I doubt if Dee even paused to think about it. He always had nothing but contempt for humankind. Sophie glanced at her brother again. She could tell by the expression on his face that he was concentrating hard, trying to keep up with a deluge of information. She knew he would want to go online and check out some of the details.
But he never caught you, she said to Flamel.
Not until today. He shrugged and smiled sadly. It was inevitable, I suppose. Throughout the 20th century, he kept getting closer. He was becoming more powerful. His organization was melding ancient magic and modern technology. Barry and I hid out in Newfoundland for a long time, until he loosed dire wolves on us. And then we drifted from city to city, starting on the East Coast in New York in 1901, and gradually moving westward. I suppose it was only a matter of time before he caught up with us, he added. Cameras, videos, phones, and the internet make it so much harder to remain hidden nowadays.
This book, this codex he was looking for, Josh began.
The Book of Abraham the Mage, Flamel clarified.
What's so special about it?
Nicholas Flamel stopped in the middle of the sidewalk so suddenly that the twins walked right past him. They turned and looked back. The rather ordinary-looking man spread his arms wide, as if he were taking a bow.
Look at me. Look at me. I am older than America. That is what is so special about the book.
Flamel lowered his voice and continued urgently.
But you know something? The secret of life eternal is probably the least of the secrets in the Codex.
Sophie found herself slipping her hand into her brother's. He squeezed lightly, and she knew, without his saying a word, that he was as frightened as she was.
With the Codex, Dee can set about changing the world.
Changing it?
Sophie's voice was a raw whisper, and abruptly the May air felt chilly.
Changing it how? Josh demanded.
Remaking it, Flamel said softly.
Dee and the Dark Elders he serves will remake this world as it was in the unimaginably ancient past. And the only place for humans in it will be as slaves. Or food.
Chapter 6.
Although there were other ways he could have used to communicate, Dr. John Dee preferred this century's method of choice.
the cell phone. Settling back into the cool leather interior of the limousine, he flipped open the phone, pointed it to where Perronel Flamel was slumped unconscious between two dripping golems, and took a quick picture. Madame Perronel Flamel, his prisoner. Now that was certainly something for the photo album. Dee keyed in a number and hit send. Then he tilted his head, looking at the graceful woman across from him. Capturing Perronel had been an extraordinary stroke of good fortune, but he knew he'd only managed it because she'd used up so much energy destroying his golem. He stroked his small triangular beard. He was going to have to make more golems soon. He looked at the two opposite. In the brief time they had been outside in the early afternoon sun, they had started to crack and melt. The big one on Perronel's left was dripping black river mud across the leather seat. Perhaps he would choose something other than golems next time. The brutish creatures worked fine in damper climates, but were especially unsuited to a West Coast summer. He wondered if he still had the recipe to create a ghoul. It was Perronel who presented him with a problem, however. A serious problem. He simply wasn't sure how powerful she was. Dee had always been rather in awe of the tall, elegant Frenchwoman. When he'd first apprenticed himself to Nicholas Flamel, the alchemist, he'd made the mistake of underestimating her. He'd quickly found that Perronel Flamel was at least as powerful as her husband. In fact, there were some areas in which she was even more powerful. Those traits that made Flamel such a brilliant alchemist, his attention to detail, his knowledge of ancient languages, his infinite patience, made him a poor sorcerer and a terrible necromancer. He simply lacked the imaginative spark of pure visualization that was needed for that work. Perronel, on the other hand, was one of the most powerful sorceresses he had ever encountered. Dee pulled off one of his gray leather gloves and dropped it onto the seat beside him. Leaning toward Perronel, he dipped his finger in the puddle of mud dripping from one of the golems and traced a curling symbol on the back of the woman's left hand. Then he painted a mirror image of the symbol on her right hand. He dipped his hand in the sticky black mud again and was inscribing three wavy lines on her forehead when she suddenly opened her bright green eyes. Dee abruptly sat back in his seat. "Madame Perronel, I cannot tell you what a pleasure it is to see you again." Perry opened her mouth to speak, but no words would form. She tried to move, but not only were the golems gripping her arms tightly, her muscles refused to obey. "Ah, you must excuse me, but I've taken the liberty of placing you under a warding spell. A simple spell, but it will suffice until I can organize something more permanent." Dee smiled, but there was nothing humorous in his expression. His cell phone trilled, playing the theme from The X-Files, and he flipped it open. "Excuse me," he said to Perronel. "You got the photo?" Dee asked. "Yes, I thought that would amuse you. The legendary Perronel Flamel in our hands. Oh, I'm quite sure Nicholas will come after her. And we'll be ready. This time he will not escape." Perronel could clearly hear the cackle of laughter on the other end. "Yes, of course." Dee reached into an inside pocket and took out the copper-bound book. "We have the codex, finally." He began to turn the thick, rough-edged pages as he spoke. His voice fell, and it was unclear whether he was talking to the caller or to himself. 10,000 years of arcane knowledge in one place. Then his voice trailed away. The phone dropped from his hand and bounced across the floor of the car. At the back of the book, two pages were missing, roughly torn out. Dee closed his eyes and then licked his lips with a quick flicking movement of his tiny tongue. "The boy," he rasped. "The boy, when I pulled it from his hand." He opened his eyes and began to scan the preceding pages carefully. "Maybe they're not important," he murmured, lips moving as he followed the shifting, moving words. He concentrated on the bright, illuminated letters at the top of every page, which gave a clue to what followed. Then he stopped abruptly, clutching the book in trembling fingers. When he raised his head, his eyes were blazing. "I'm missing the final summoning," he howled. Yellow sparks danced around his head, and the rear window behind him bloomed a spiderweb of white cracks. Tendrils of yellow-white power dripped from his teeth like saliva.
"Go back!" he roared to the driver. "Go back now!"
"No, stop! Cancel that order! Flamel's no fool. They'll be long gone." He snatched the phone off the floor, and avoiding Perronel's eyes, took a moment to compose himself. He drew in a deep, shuddering breath and visibly calmed himself, then dialed. "We have a slight problem," he said crisply into the phone, voice calm and unemotional. "We seem to be missing a couple of pages from the back of the book. Nothing important, I'm sure. Perhaps you would do me a courtesy," he said very casually. "You might convey to the Morrigan that I am in need of her services." Dee noticed that Perronel's eyes had widened in shock at the mention of the name. He grinned in delight. "Tell her I need her special talents and particular skills." Then he snapped the phone shut and looked over at Perronel Flamel. "It would have been so much easier if they had just given me the codex. Now the Morrigan is coming, and you know what that means."
Chapter 7 Sophie spotted the rat first. The twins had grown up in New York and had spent most of their summers in California, so encountering a rat was nothing new. Living in San Francisco, a port city, one quickly got used to seeing the creatures, especially early in the morning and late at night when they came out of the shadows and sewers. Sophie wasn't especially frightened of them, though like everyone else, she had heard the horror stories, urban legends and FOAF, friend of a friend stories, about the scavengers. She knew they were mostly harmless unless cornered. She thought she remembered reading somewhere that they could jump to great heights. She'd also read an article in the New York Times Sunday magazine that said there were as many rats in the United States as there were people. But this rat was different. Sleek and black, rather than the usual filthy brown, it crouched, unmoving, at the mouth of the alleyway, and Sophie could have sworn that its eyes were bright red, and watching them. Maybe it was an escaped pet. "Ah, you've noticed," Flamel murmured, catching her arm, urging her forward. "We're being watched." "Who?" Josh asked, confused, turning quickly, expecting to see Dee's long black car cruising down the street. But there was no sign of any car, and no one seemed to be paying them any special attention. "Where?" "The rat. In the alleyway," Nicholas Flamel said quickly. "Don't look." But it was too late. Josh had already turned and looked.
"By a rat? A rat is watching us?
You cannot be serious." He stared hard at the rat, expecting it to turn and scuttle away. It just raised its head and looked at him, its mouth opening to reveal pointed teeth. Josh shuddered. Snakes and rats. He hated them equally, though not as much as he hated spiders and scorpions.
"Rats don't have red eyes, do they?"
he asked, looking at his sister, who, as far as he knew, was afraid of nothing.
"Not usually," she said.
When he turned back, he discovered that there were now two jet-black rats standing still in the alleyway. A third scuttled out of the gloom and settled down to watch them.
"Okay," Josh said evenly. "I've seen men made of mud. I guess I can accept spying rats."
"Do they talk?" he wondered aloud.
"Don't be ridiculous," Flamel snapped. "They're rats."
Josh really didn't think it was such a ridiculous suggestion.
"Has Dee sent them?"
Sophie asked.
"He's tracking us. The rats have followed our scent from the shop. A simple scrying spell allows him to see what they see. They are a crude but effective tool, and once they have our scent, they can follow us until we cross water. But I'm more concerned about those."
He tilted his chin upward. Sophie and Josh looked up. Gathering on the rooftops of the surrounding buildings were an extraordinary number of black-feathered birds.
"Crows," Flamel said shortly.
"That's bad?"
Sophie guessed. From the moment Dee had stepped into the shop, There hadn't been a whole lot of good news.
It could be very bad, but I think we'll be okay. We're nearly there.
He turned to the left and led the twins into the heart of San Francisco's exotic Chinatown. They passed the Sam Wong Hotel, then turned right into a cramped back street, then immediately left into an even narrower alleyway. Off the relatively clean main streets, the alleyways were piled high with boxes and open bins that stank with that peculiarly sweet, sour odor of rotten food. The narrow alley they had turned into was especially foul-smelling, the air practically solid with flies, and the buildings on either side rose so high that the passage was in gloomy shadow.
"I think I'm going to be sick," Sophie muttered.
Only the day before, she'd said to her twin that the weeks working in the coffee shop had really heightened her sense of smell. She'd boasted that she was able to distinguish odors she'd never smelled before. Now she was regretting it. The air was rancid with the stink of rotten fruit and fish. Josh just nodded. He was concentrating on breathing through his mouth, though he imagined that every foul breath was coating his tongue.
"Nearly there," Flamel said.
He seemed unaffected by the rank odors whirling about them. The twins heard a rasping, skittering sound and turned in time to see five jet-black rats scramble across the tops of the open bins behind them. A huge black crow settled on one of the wires that crisscrossed the alleyway. Nicholas Flamel suddenly stopped outside a plain, unmarked wooden door so encrusted with grime that it was virtually indistinguishable from the wall. There was no handle or keyhole. Spreading his right hand wide, Flamel placed his fingertips at specific locations and pressed. The door clicked open. Grabbing Sophie and Josh, he pulled them into the shadow and eased the door shut behind them. After the bitter stench of the alleyways, the hallway smelled wonderful, sweet with jasmine and other subtle exotic odors. The twins breathed deeply.
"Bergamot," Sophie announced, identifying the orange odor. "And ylang ylang and patchouli, I think."
"I'm impressed," Flamel said.
"I got used to the herbs in the tea shop. I loved the odors of the exotic teas."
She stopped, suddenly realizing that she was talking as if she would never go back to the shop and smell its gorgeous odors again. "Right about now, the first of the early afternoon crowd will be coming in, ordering cappuccinos and lattes, iced tea and herbal infusions." She blinked away the sudden tears that prickled at her eyes. She missed the coffee cup because it was ordinary and normal and real.
"Where are we?"
Josh asked, looking around now that his eyes had become accustomed to the dim light. They were standing in a long, narrow, spotlessly clean hallway. The walls were covered in smooth blonde wood, and there were intricately woven white reed mats on the floor. A simple doorway covered in what looked like paper stood at the opposite end of the corridor. Josh was about to take a step toward the door when Flamel's iron hand clamped onto his shoulder.
"Don't move," he murmured. "Wait. Look. Notice. If you keep those three words in mind, you just might survive the next few days."
Digging into his pocket, he picked out a quarter. Positioning it on his thumb, he flicked it into the air. It spun over and over and began to fall toward the middle of the hallway. There was a barely perceptible hiss, and a needle-tipped dart punched right through the metal coin, impaling it in midair and pinning it to the opposite wall.
"You've left the safe and mundane world you once knew," Nicholas Flamel said seriously, looking at each twin in turn. "Nothing is as it seems. You must learn to question everything, to wait before moving, to look before stepping, and to observe everything. I learned these lessons in alchemy, but you will find them invaluable in this new world you've unwittingly wandered into."
He pointed down the corridor.
"Look and observe. Tell me, what do you see?"
Josh spotted the first tiny hole in the wall. It was camouflaged to look like a knot in the wood. Once he found the first one, he realized that there were dozens of holes in the walls. He wondered if each hole held a tiny dart that was powerful enough to punch through metal. Sophie noticed that the floor did not join neatly with the wall. In three separate places, on both the left and right-hand sides, close to the skirting, there was a definite gap. Flamel nodded. Well done. Now watch. We've seen what the darts can do, but there is another defense. He took a tissue out of his pocket and tossed it onto the floor, close to one of the narrow openings. There was a single metallic clink, and then a huge half-moon-shaped blade popped out from the wall, sliced the tissue into confetti, and slid back into hiding. So, if the darts don't get you, Josh began.
The blades will, Sophie finished. Well, how do we get to the door?
We don't, Flamel said, and turned to push on the wall to the left. An entire section clicked open and swung back, allowing the trio to step into a huge, airy room. The twins recognized the room immediately. It was a dojo, a martial arts school. Since they were little, they had studied Taekwondo in dojang like this across the United States as they traveled with their parents from university to university. Many schools had martial arts clubs on campus, and their parents always enrolled them in the best dojo they could find. Both Sophie and Josh were red belts, one rank below a black belt. Unlike other dojos, however, this one was plain and unadorned, decorated in shades of white and cream, with white walls and black mats dotted across the floor. But what immediately caught their attention was the single figure dressed in a white t-shirt and white jeans, sitting with its back to them in the center of the room. The figure's spiky, bright red hair was the only spot of color in the entire dojo.
"We've got a problem," Nicholas Flamel said simply, addressing the figure.
"You've got a problem. That's nothing to do with me."
The figure didn't turn, but the voice was surprisingly both female and young, the accent soft and vaguely Celtic, Irish or Scottish, Sophie thought.
"Dee found me today."
"It was only a matter of time."
"He came after me with golems."
There was a pause. Still the figure didn't turn.
"He always was a fool. You don't use golems in a dry climate. That's his arrogance."
"He has taken Perronel prisoner."
"Ah, that's tough. He'll not harm her, though."
"And he has the codex."
The figure moved, coming slowly to her feet and turning to face them. The twins were shocked to discover that they were looking at a girl, not much older than themselves. Her skin was pale, dappled with freckles, and her round face was dominated by grass-green eyes. Her red hair was so vibrant that Sophie wondered if she had dyed it that color.
"The codex?"
The accent was definitely Irish, Sophie decided.
"The Book of Abraham the Mage?"
Nicholas Flamel nodded.
"Then you're right. We do have a problem."
Flamel reached into his pocket and pulled out the two pages Josh had torn from it.
"Well, nearly all of the book. He's missing the final summoning."
The young woman hissed, the sound like that of water boiling, and a quick smile flickered across her face.
"Which he will want, of course."
"Of course."
Josh was watching the red-haired young woman intently, noting how she stood perfectly still, like most of the martial art teachers he knew. He glanced sidelong at his sister and raised his eyebrows in a silent question as he inclined his chin slightly toward the girl. Sophie shook her head. They were curious why Nicholas Flamel treated her with such obvious respect. Sophie had also come to the conclusion that there was something wrong about the girl's expression, but she couldn't quite put her finger on it. It was an ordinary face. Perhaps the cheekbones were a little too prominent, the chin a little too pointed, but the emerald-colored eyes caught and held one's attention. And then Sophie realized with a start that the girl didn't blink. The young woman suddenly threw back her head and breathed deeply, her nostrils flaring.
"Is that why I can smell eyes?"
Flamel nodded.
Rats and crows everywhere.
And you brought them here?
There was a note of accusation in her voice.
I've spent years building this place.
If Dee has the codex, then you know what he will do with it. The young woman nodded. She turned her wide green eyes on the twins.
And these two?
She asked, finally acknowledging their presence. They were there when Dee attacked. They fought for me, and this young man managed to tear the pages from the book. This is Sophie, and this is her twin, Josh.
Twins?
The young woman stepped forward and looked at each of them in turn.
Not identical, but I can see the resemblance now.
She turned to Flamel.
You're not thinking...
I'm thinking it's an interesting turn of events, Flamel said mysteriously. He looked at the twins. I would like to introduce you to Skatak. She'll probably not tell you much about herself, so I'll tell you that she is of the Elder Race and has trained every warrior and hero of legend for the past 2,000 years. In mythology, she is known as the Warrior Maid, the Shadow, the Demon Slayer, the Kingmaker, the...
Oh, just call me Scatty,
the young woman said, her cheeks turning the same color as her hair. Chapter 8 Dr. John Dee crouched in the back of the car and attempted, not entirely successfully, to control his temper. The air was heavy with the odor of sulfur, and thin tendrils of yellow-white fire crackled around his fingertips and puddled on the floor. He had failed, and while his masters were particularly patient, they often instigated plans that took centuries to mature, their patience was now beginning to run out, and they were definitely not known for their compassion. Unmoving, held by the warding spell, Perronel Flamel watched him, eyes blazing with a combination of loathing and what might even have been fear. This is becoming complicated, Dee muttered, and I hate complications. Dee was holding a flat silver dish in his lap, into which he had poured a can of soda, the only liquid he had available. He always preferred to work with pure water, but technically any fluid would do. Crouched over the dish, he stared into the liquid and allowed a little of his own auric energy to trickle across the surface as he muttered the first words of the spell of scrying. For a single moment, there was just his own reflection in the dark liquid. Then it shuddered, and the soda began to bubble and boil furiously. When the liquid settled, the image in the bowl no longer reflected Dee's face, but showed a curiously flat image, rendered in shades of purple-gray and greenish-black. The viewpoint was close to the ground, shifting and moving with sickening rapidity. Rats, Dee murmured, thin lips curling with distaste. He hated using rats as eyes.
I cannot believe you led them here,
Scatty said, shoving handfuls of clothes into a backpack. Nicholas Flamel stood in the doorway of Scatty's tiny bedroom, arms folded across his chest. Everything happened so fast. It was bad enough when Dee got the codex, but when I realized there were pages missing, I knew the twins would be in trouble. At the mention of the word twins, Scatty looked up from her packing.
They're the real reason you're here, aren't they?
Flamel suddenly found something very interesting to stare at on the wall. Scatty strode across the small room, glanced out into the hall to make sure Sophie and Josh were still in the kitchen, and then pulled Flamel into the room and pushed the door closed.
You're up to something, aren't you?
She demanded.
This is about more than just the loss of the Codex. You could have taken Dee and his minions on your own.
Don't be so sure. It's been a long time since I fought Skatok, Flamel said gently. The only alchemy I do now is to brew a little of the Philosopher's Stone potion to keep Perronel and myself young. Occasionally I'll make a little gold or the odd jewel when we need some money. Scatty coughed a short humorless laugh and spun back to her packing. She had changed into a pair of black combat pants, steel-toed magnum boots, and a black t-shirt,
over which she wore a black vest covered in pockets and zippers. She pushed a second pair of trousers into her backpack, found one sock, and went looking for its match under her bed.
"Nicholas Flamel," she said, her voice muffled by the blankets, "you are the most powerful alchemist in the known world. Remember, I stood beside you when we fought the demon Fomor, and you were the one who rescued me from the dungeons of An-Khor Tahnach, and not the other way around."
She came out from under the bed with the missing sock.
"When the Rasulka were terrorizing St. Petersburg, you alone turned them back, and when Black Annis raged across Manitoba, I watched you defeat her. You alone faced down the Night Hag and her undead army. You spent more than half a millennium reading and studying the Codex. No one is more familiar with the stories and legends it holds."
Scatty stopped suddenly and gasped, green eyes widening.
"That's what this is about," she said. "This is to do with a legend."
Flamel reached out and pressed his forefinger to Scatty's lips, preventing her from saying another word. His smile was enigmatic.
"Do you trust me?"
he asked her eventually. Her response was immediate.
"Without question."
"Then trust me. I want you to protect the twins. And train them," he added.
"Train them? Do you know what you're asking?"
Flamel nodded.
"I want you to prepare them for what is to come."
"And what is that?"
Skatok asked.
"I have no idea," Flamel smiled, "except that it is going to be bad."
"We're fine, Mom. Honestly, we're fine." Sophie Newman tilted the cell phone slightly so that her brother could listen in.
"Yes, Perry Fleming was feeling sick. Something she ate, probably. She's fine now."
Sophie could feel the beads of sweat gathering in the small hairs at the back of her neck. She was uncomfortable lying to her mother, even though her mother was so wrapped up in her work that she never bothered to check. Josh and Sophie's parents were archaeologists. They were known worldwide for their discoveries, which had helped reshape modern archaeology. They were among the first in their field to discover the existence of the new species of small hominids that were now commonly called hobbits in Indonesia. Josh always said that their parents lived 5 million years in the past and were only happy when they were up to their ankles in mud. The twins knew that they were loved unconditionally, but they also knew that their parents simply didn't understand them, or much else about modern life.
"Mr. Fleming is taking Perry out to their house in the desert, and they've asked us if we'd like to go with them for a little break.
We said we had to ask you first, of course."
"Yes, we spoke to Aunt Agnes. She said so long as it was okay with you."
"Say yes, Mom, please."
She turned to her brother and crossed her fingers. He crossed his too. They had talked long and hard about what to say to their aunt and their mother before they made the calls, but they weren't entirely sure what they were going to do if their mother said they couldn't go. Sophie uncrossed her fingers and gave her brother a thumbs up.
"Yes, I've got time off from the coffee shop. No, we won't be a bother. Yes, Mom. Yes. Love to you, and tell Dad we love him too."
Sophie listened, then moved the phone away from her mouth.
"Dad found a dozen pseudo-archaleptus sharpie in near-perfect condition," she reported.
Josh looked blank.
"A very rare Cambrian crustacean," she explained.
Her brother nodded.
"Tell Dad that's great. We'll keep in touch," he called out.
"Love you,"
Sophie said, cutting the conversation short, then hung up.
"I hate lying to her," she said immediately.
"I know, but you couldn't really tell her the truth now, could you?"
Sophie shrugged.
"I guess not."
Josh turned back to the sink. His laptop was perched precariously on the draining board next to his cell phone. He was using the cell to go online because, shockingly, there was no phone line or internet connection in the dojo. Scatty lived above the dojo in a small two-room apartment with a kitchen at one end of the hall and a bedroom with a tiny bathroom at the other. A little balcony connected the two rooms and looked down directly onto the dojo below. The twins were standing in the kitchen while Flamel brought Scatty up to date on the events of the past hour in her bedroom at the other end of the hall.
"What do you think of her?"
Josh asked casually, concentrating on his laptop. He'd managed to get online, but the connection speed was crawlingly slow.
He called up Alta Vista and typed in a dozen versions of Skatoch before he finally got a hit with the correct spelling. Here she is. 27,000 hits for Skatoch, the shadow or the shadowy one, he said, then added offhandedly, I think she's cool. Sophie picked up on the too casual tone immediately. She smiled broadly and her eyebrows shot up.
Who? Oh, you mean the 2,000-year-old warrior maid. Don't you think she might be a little too old for you?
A wash of color rose from beneath the neck of Josh's t-shirt, painting his cheeks bright red. Let me try Google, he muttered, fingers rattling across the keyboard. 46,000 hits for Skatoch, he said. Looks like she's real, too. Let's see what Wiki has to say about her, he went on, and then realized that Sophie wasn't even looking at him. He turned to her and discovered that she was staring fixedly through the window. There was a rat standing on the rooftop of the building across the alley, staring at them. As they watched, it was joined by a second and then a third.
They're here, Sophie whispered.
Dee concentrated on keeping his lunch down. Looking through the rat's eyes was a nauseating experience. Because of their tiny brain, it required a huge effort of will to keep the creature focused, which, in an alleyway filled with rotten food, was no easy task. Dee was momentarily grateful that he had not used the full force of the scrying spell, which would have allowed him to hear, to taste, and this was a terrifying thought, to smell everything the rat encountered. It was like looking at a badly tuned black-and-white television. The image shifted, pitched, and lurched with the rat's every movement. The rat could go from running horizontally on the ground to running vertically up a wall, then upside down across a rope, all within a matter of seconds. Then the image stabilized. Directly in front of Dee, outlined in purple-tinged gray and glowing in grayish-black, were the two humans he had seen in the bookshop, a boy and a girl, in their mid-teens, perhaps, and similar enough in appearance for them to be related. A sudden thought struck him hard enough to break his concentration. Brother and sister, possibly. Or could they be something else? Surely not. He looked back into the scrying dish and concentrated with his full will, forcing the rat he was controlling to stand absolutely still. Dee focused on the young man and woman, trying to decide if one was older than the other. But the rat's vision was too clouded and distorted for him to be sure. But if they were the same age, that meant they were twins. That was curious. He looked at them again and then shook his head. They were humans. Dismissing the thought, he unleashed a single command that rippled through every rat within a half-mile radius of the twins' position. Destroy them. Destroy them utterly. The gathering crows took to the air, cawing raucously as if applauding. Josh watched open-mouthed as a huge rat leapt from the roof opposite, effortlessly bridging the 6-foot space. Its mouth was wide, and its teeth were wickedly pointed. He managed a brief, "Hey!" and jerked away from the window just as the rat hit the glass with a furry, wet thump. It slid down to the alley one floor below, where it staggered around in stunned surprise. Josh grabbed Sophie's hand and dragged her out of the kitchen and onto the balcony. "We've got a problem," he shouted, and stopped. Below them, three huge golems, trailing flaking dried mud, were pushing their way through the wide open alley door, and behind them, in a long sinuous line, came the rats. Chapter 9. The three golems moved stiffly into the corridor, spotted the open door at the far end of the hallway, and moved toward it. The finger-length metal darts hissed from the walls and stuck deeply into their hardened mud skin, but didn't even slow the creatures down. The half-moon blades close to the floor were a different matter altogether. The blades clicked out of their concealed sheaths in the walls and sliced into the ankles of the clay men. The first creature crashed to the floor, hitting it with the sound of wet mud. The second tottered on 1 foot before it slowly toppled forward, hit the wall, and slid down, leaving a muddy smear in its wake.
The semicircular blades click-clacked again, slicing the creatures completely in two, and then the golems abruptly reverted to their muddy origin. Thick globules of mud spattered everywhere. The third golem, the largest of the creatures, stopped. Its black stone eyes moved dully over the remains of its two companions, and then it turned and punched a huge fist directly into the wall, first to the right, then to the left. A whole section of the wall on the left-hand side gave way, revealing the space beyond. The golem stepped into the dojo and looked around, black eyes still and unmoving. The rats, meanwhile, raced toward the open door at the end of the corridor. Most of them survived the scything blades. In the speeding limousine, Dr. John Dee released his control of the rats, and now concentrated his attention on the surviving golem. Controlling the artificial creature was much easier. Golems were mindless beings, created of mud mixed with stones or gravel to give their flesh consistency, and brought to life by a simple spell written on a square of parchment and pressed into their mouths. Sorcerers had been building golems of all shapes and sizes for thousands of years. They were the source of every zombie and Walking Dead story ever created. Dee himself had told the story of the greatest of all the golems, the Red Golem of Prague, to Mary Shelley one cold winter's evening when she, Lord Byron, the poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, and the mysterious Dr. Polidori were visiting his castle in Switzerland in 1816. Less than 6 months later, Mary created the story of the modern Prometheus, the book that became more commonly known as Frankenstein. The monster in her book was just like a golem, created of spare parts and brought to life by magical science. Golems were impervious to most weapons, though a sudden fall or blow could shatter their mud skin, especially if it was dry and hardening. In a damp climate, their skins rarely dried out and could absorb incredible punishment, but this warm climate made them brittle, which was why they had fallen so easily to the concealed blades. Some sorcerers used glass or mirrors for their eyes, but Dee preferred highly polished black stones. They enabled him to see with almost razor-sharp clarity, albeit in monochrome. Dee caused the golem to tilt his head upward. Directly above him, on a narrow balcony overlooking the dojo, were the pale and terrified faces of the teens. Dee smiled, and the golem's lips mimicked the movement. He'd deal with Flamel first, then he'd take care of the witnesses. Suddenly, Nicholas Flamel's head appeared, followed, a moment later, by the distinctive spiky hair of the warrior maid, Skatok. Dee's smile faded, and he could feel his heart sink. Why did it have to be Skatok? He'd had no idea that the red-haired warrior was in the city, or even on this continent, for that matter. Last he'd heard of her, she was singing in an all-girl band in Berlin. Through the golem's eyes, Dee watched both Flamel and Skatok leap over the railing and float down to stand directly in front of the mud man. Skatok spoke directly to Dee, but this particular golem had no ears and couldn't hear, so he had no idea what she had just said. A threat, probably. A promise, certainly. Flamel drifted away, moving toward the door, which was now dark and heaving with rats, leaving Scatty to face him and the golem alone. Maybe she wasn't as good as she'd once been, he thought desperately. Maybe time had dulled her powers.
We should help, Josh said.
And do what? Sophie asked, without a trace of sarcasm. They were both standing on the balcony, looking down into the dojo. They had watched open-mouthed as Flamel and Scatty leaped over the edge and drifted far too slowly to the ground. The red-haired girl faced the huge golem, while Flamel hurried to the door where the rats were gathering. The vermin seemed reluctant to enter the room. Without warning, the golem swung a huge fist, then followed it up with a massive kick. Josh opened his mouth to shout a warning, but he didn't get a chance to say anything before Scatty moved. One moment she was standing directly in front of the creature, then she was throwing herself forward, moving under the blows, closing right in on it.
Her hand moved, blurringly fast, and she delivered a flat, open-handed blow to the point of the golem's jaw. There was a liquid squelch, and then its jaw unhinged and its mouth gaped open. In the blackness of its maw, the twins could clearly see a yellow rectangle of paper. The creature struck out wildly, and Scatty danced back out of range. It lashed out a kick, which missed and struck the polished floorboards, shattering them to splinters.
"We've got to help," Sophie said.
"How?" Josh shouted, but his twin had run into the kitchen, desperately looking for a weapon. She emerged a moment later carrying a small microwave oven.
"Sophie," Josh murmured, "what are you going to do with—"
Sophie heaved the microwave over the edge of the railing. It struck the golem full in the chest and stuck, globules of mud spattering everywhere. The golem stopped, confused and disorientated. Scatty took advantage of its disorientation and moved in again, feet and hands striking blows from all angles, further confusing the creature. Another blow from the golem came close enough to ruffle Scatty's spiky red hair, but she caught its arm and used it as leverage to spin the creature to the floor. Floorboards cracked and snapped as it hit them. Then her hand shot out and almost delicately plucked the paper square from the golem's mouth. Instantly, the golem returned to its muddy origins, splashing foul, stinking water and dirt across the once pristine dojo floor. The microwave rattled to the ground.
"I guess no one's cooking anything in that," Josh murmured.
Scatty waved the square of paper at the twins.
"Every magical creature is kept animated by a spell that is either in or on its body. All you have to do is remove it to break the spell. Remember that."
Josh glanced quickly at his sister. He knew she was thinking the same thing he was. If they ever came up against a golem again, there was no way they were getting close enough to stick their hands in its mouth. Nicholas Flamel approached the rats warily. Underestimating them would be deadly indeed, but while he had no difficulty fighting and destroying magical creatures, which were never properly alive in the first place, he was reluctant to destroy living creatures, even if they were rats. Perry would have no such compunction, he knew, but he had been an alchemist for far too long. He was dedicated to preserving life, not destroying it. The rats were under Dee's control. The poor creatures were probably terrified, though that would not stop them from eating him. Flamel crouched on the floor, turned his right hand palm up, and curled the fingers inward. He blew gently into his hand, and a tiny ball of green mist immediately formed. Then he suddenly turned his hand and plunged it straight into the polished floorboards, his fingers actually penetrating the wood. The tiny ball of green energy splashed across the room like a stain. Then the alchemist closed his eyes, and his aura flared around his body. Concentrating, he directed his auric energy to flow through his fingers into the floor. The wood started to glow. Still watching from the landing, the twins were unsure what Flamel was doing. They could see the faint green glow around his body, rising off his flesh like mist, but they couldn't work out why the furry mass of rats gathered in the doorway had not burst into the room.
"Maybe there's some sort of spell keeping them from coming in," Sophie said, knowing instinctively that her twin was thinking the same thing.
Scatty heard her. She was systematically shredding the yellow square of paper she'd taken from the golem's mouth to tiny pieces.
"It's just a simple warding spell," she called up, "designed to keep bugs and vermin off the floor. I used to come in here every morning and find bug droppings and moths all over the place. It took ages to sweep it clean. The warding spell is keeping the rats at bay, but all it takes is one to break through, and the spell will be broken. Then they'll all come."
Nicholas Flamel was fully aware that John Dee could probably see him through the eyes of the rats. He picked up the largest, a cat-sized creature that remained unmoving while the rest of the vermin scuttled and heaved about it. With his right hand still buried in the floorboard, Flamel pointed his left hand directly at the rat. The creature twitched, and for a single instant its eyes blazed with sickly yellow light.
"Dr. John Dee,
You have made the biggest mistake of your long life. I will be coming for you, Flamel promised aloud.
Dee glanced up from his scrying bowl to see that Perronel Flamel was wide awake and watching him intently.
Ah, madam, you are just in time to see my creatures overpower your husband. Plus, I'll finally have an opportunity to deal with that pest, Skatok, and I'll have the pages of the book.
Dee didn't notice that Perronel's eyes had widened at the mention of Skatok's name.
All in all, a good day's work, I think.
He focused his full attention on the biggest rat and issued two simple commands. Attack. Kill. Dee closed his eyes as the rat uncoiled and launched itself into the room. The green light flowed out from Flamel's fingers and ran along the floorboards, outlining the planks in green light. Abruptly, the wooden floor sprouted twigs, branches, leaves, and then a tree trunk. Then another, and a third. Within a dozen heartbeats, a thicket of trees sprouted out of the floor and were visibly climbing toward the ceiling. Some of the trunks were no thicker than a finger, others were wrist thick, and one, close to the door, was so wide it almost filled the opening. The rats turned and scattered, squealing as they raced down the corridor, desperately attempting to leap over the click-clacking blades. Flamel scrambled back and climbed to his feet, brushing off his hands.
One of the oldest secrets of alchemy, he announced to the wide-eyed twins and Scatty, is that every living thing, from the most complex creatures right down to the simplest leaf, carries the seeds of its creation within itself.
DNA, Josh murmured, staring at the forest sprouting and growing behind Flamel. Sophie looked around the once spotless dojo. It was now filthy, spattered and splashed with muddy water, the smoothly polished floorboards broken and cracked with the trees growing from them, more of foul-smelling mud in the hallway.
Are you saying that alchemists knew about DNA? She asked.
The alchemist nodded delightfully.
Exactly. When Watson and Crick announced that they had discovered what they called the secret of life in 1953, they were merely rediscovering something alchemists have always known.
You're telling me that you somehow woke the DNA in those floorboards and forced trees to grow?
Josh said, choosing his words carefully.
How?
Flamel turned to look at the forest that was now taking over the entire dojo.
It's called magic, he said delightedly, and I wasn't sure I could do it anymore, until Scatty reminded me, he added.
Chapter 10
So let me get this straight, Josh Newman said, trying to keep his voice perfectly level.
You don't know how to drive? Neither of you?
Josh and Sophie were sitting in the front seats of the SUV Scatty had borrowed from one of her martial arts students. Josh was driving, and his sister had a map on her lap. Nicholas Flamel and Skatok were sitting in the back.
Never learned, Nicholas Flamel said, with an expressive shrug.
Never had the time,
Scatty said shortly.
But Nicholas told us that you're more than 2,000 years old. Sophie said, looking at the girl.
2,517, as you humani measure time with your current calendar, Scatty mumbled.
She looked into Flamel's clear eyes.
And how old do I look?
Not a day over 17, he said quickly.
Couldn't you have found time to learn how to drive?
Sophie persisted. She'd wanted to learn how to drive since she was 10. One of the reasons the twins had taken summer jobs this year, rather than go on the dig with their parents, was to get the money for a car of their own. Skatok shrugged, an irritated twitch of her shoulders.
I've been meaning to, but I've been busy, she protested.
You do know, Josh said to no one in particular, that I'm not supposed to be driving without a licensed driver with me.
We're nearly 15 and a half, and we can both drive. Sophie said.
Well, sort of, she added.
Can either of you ride a horse? Flamel asked. Or drive a carriage? Or a coach and four?
Well, no,
Sophie began. Handle a war chariot while firing a bow, or launching spears, Scatty added. Or fly a lizard na hare while using a slingshot. I have no idea what a lizard na hare is, and I'm not sure I want to know either.
So, you see, you are experienced in certain skills, Flamel said, whereas we have other, somewhat older, but equally useful skills. He shot a sidelong glance at Skatok, though I'm not so sure about the Nahair flying anymore.
Josh pulled away from a stop sign and turned right, heading for the Golden Gate Bridge. I just don't know how you could have lived through the 20th century without being able to drive. I mean, how did you get from place to place?
Public transportation, Flamel said with a grim smile. Trains and buses, mainly. They are a completely anonymous method of travel, unlike airplanes and boats. There's far too much paperwork involved in owning a car, paperwork that could be traced directly to us, no matter how many aliases we use. He paused and added, and besides, there are other, older methods of travel. There were 100 questions Josh wanted to ask, but he was concentrating furiously on controlling the heavy car. Although he knew how to drive, the only vehicles he'd actually driven were battered jeeps when they accompanied their parents on a dig. He'd never driven in traffic before, and he was terrified. Sophie had suggested that he pretend it was a computer game. That helped, but only a little. In a game, when you crashed, you simply started again. Here, a crash was for keeps. Traffic was slow across the famous bridge. A long gray stretch limo had broken down in the inside lane, causing a bottleneck. As they approached, Sophie noticed that there were 2 dark-suited figures crouched under the hood on the passenger side. She realized she was holding her breath as they drew close, wondering if the figures were golems. She heaved a sigh as they pulled alongside and discovered that the men looked like harassed accountants. Josh glanced at his sister and attempted a grin, and she knew he'd been thinking the same thing. Sophie twisted in her seat and turned to look back at Flamel and Scatty. In the darkened, air-conditioned interior of the SUV, they seemed so ordinary. Flamel looked like a fading hippie, and Scatty, despite her rather military dress sense, wouldn't have looked out of place behind the counter at the coffee cup. The red-haired girl had propped her chin on her fist and was staring through the darkened glass across the bay toward Alcatraz. Nicholas Flamel dipped his head to follow the direction of her gaze. "Haven't been there for a while," he murmured.
"We did the tour," Sophie said. "I liked it," Josh said quickly. Sophie didn't.
"It was creepy." "And so it should be," Flamel said quietly. "It is home to an extraordinary assortment of ghosts and unquiet spirits. Last time I was there, it was to put to rest an extremely ugly snake man."
"I'm not sure I even want to know what a snake man is," Sophie muttered, then paused. "You know, a couple of hours ago, I could never have imagined myself saying something like that." Nicholas Flamel sat back in the comfortable seats and folded his arms across his chest.
"Your lives, yours and your brother's, are now forever altered. You know that, don't you?"
Sophie nodded.
"That's beginning to sink in now. It's just that everything's happening so fast that it's hard to take it all in. Mudmen, magic, books of spells, rats." She looked at Skatoch. "Ancient warriors."
Scatty dipped her head in acknowledgement.
"And, of course, a 600-year-old alchemist."
Sophie stopped, a sudden thought crossing her mind. She looked from Flamel to Scatty and back again. Then she took a moment to formulate her question. Staring hard at the man, she asked,
"You are human, aren't you?"
Nicholas Flamel grinned.
"Yes. Perhaps a little more than human, but yes, I was born and will always be one of the human race."
Sophie looked at Skatoch.
"But you're..."
Skatoch opened her green eyes wide, and for a single instant, something ancient was visible in the planes and angles of her face.
"No," she said very quietly, "I am not of the race of Humani.
My people were of different stock, the Elder Race. We ruled this earth before the creatures who became humani climbed down from the trees. Nowadays, we are remembered in the myths of just about every race. We are the creatures of legend, the were-clans, the vampire, the giants, the dragons, the monsters. In stories, we are remembered as the Old Ones, or the Elder Race. Some stories call us gods.
Were you ever a god?
Sophie whispered.
Scatty giggled.
No, I was never a god. But some of my people allowed themselves to be worshipped as gods. Others simply became gods as humani told tales of their adventures.
She shrugged.
They were just another race, an older race than man with different gifts, different skills.
What happened?
Sophie asked.
The flood,
Scatty said very softly,
amongst other things.
The earth is a lot older than most people imagine, Flamel said quietly. Creatures and races that are now no more than myth once walked this world.
Sophie nodded slowly.
Our parents are archaeologists. They've told us about some of the inexplicable things that archaeology sometimes reveals.
Remember that place we visited in Texas? Taylor something?
Josh said, carefully easing the heavy SUV into the middle lane. He'd never driven anything so big before and was terrified he was going to hit something. He'd had a couple of near misses and was convinced he'd actually clipped someone's side mirror, but he kept going, saying nothing.
The Taylor Trail, Sophie said, at the Paluxy River in Texas. There are what look like dinosaur footprints and human prints in the same fossilized piece of stone, and the stone is dated to 100 million years old.
I have seen them, Flamel replied, and others like them all across the world. I've also examined the shoe print that was found in Antelope Springs in Utah, in rock, about 500 million years old.
My dad says that things like that can be easily dismissed as either fakes or misinterpretation of the facts,
Josh said quickly. He wondered what his father would say about the things they had seen today. Flamel shrugged.
Yes, that is true. But what science cannot understand, it dismisses. Not everything can be so easily brushed aside. Can you dismiss what you've seen and experienced today as some sort of misinterpretation of the facts?
Sophie shook her head. Beside her, Josh shrugged uncomfortably.
He didn't like the direction this conversation was taking. Dinosaurs and humans living together at the same time was simply inconceivable. The very idea went against everything his parents had taught them, everything they believed. But somewhere at the back of his mind, a small voice kept reminding him that every year archaeologists, including his parents, kept making extraordinary discoveries. A couple of years earlier, it was Homo floresiensis, the tiny people in Indonesia, nicknamed hobbits. Then there was the species of dwarf dinosaur discovered in Germany, and the 165-million-year-old dinosaur tracks found in Wyoming, and, only recently, the 8 new prehistoric species discovered in a cave in Israel. But what Flamel was suggesting was staggering in its implications.
You're saying that humans and dinosaurs existed on the earth at the same time,
Josh said, surprised that he sounded so angry.
I'm saying that humans have existed on the earth with creatures far stranger and much older than the dinosaurs, Flamel said seriously.
How do you know?
Sophie demanded.
He claimed to have been born in 1330. He couldn't have seen dinosaurs, could he?
It's all written down in the Codex. And in the course of my long life, I've seen beasts that are considered myths. I've fought beings from legend. I've faced down creatures that looked like they crawled from a nightmare.
We did Shakespeare in school last term. There's a line from Hamlet.
Sophie frowned, trying to remember.
There are more things in heaven and earth.
Nicholas Flamel nodded delightedly.
Than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
He finished the quotation.
Hamlet, Act 1, Scene 5.
I knew William Shakespeare, of course.
Now Will could have been an alchemist of extraordinary talent, but then he fell into Dee's clutches.
Poor Will. Do you know that he based the character of Prospero in The Tempest on Dee?
I never liked Shakespeare, Scatty muttered. He smelled.
You knew Shakespeare? Josh was unable to keep the disbelief out of his voice.
He was my student, briefly.
Very briefly, Flamel said. I've lived a long time. I've had a lot of students, some made famous by history, most forgotten. I've met a lot of people, human and unhuman, mortal and immortal, people like Scatach, Flamel finished.
There are more like you? More of the elder race? Sophie asked, looking at the red-haired girl.
More than you might think, though I try not to associate with them, Scatty said uneasily.
There are those amongst the elders who cannot accept that our time is past, that this age belongs to the humani. They want to see a return to the old ways, and they believe that their puppet, Dee, and others like him are in a position to bring that about. They are called the Dark Elders.
I don't know if anyone has noticed, Josh interrupted suddenly, but would you say there are a lot of birds gathering?
Sophie turned to stare through the windshield, while Flamel and Scatty peered through the back window. The spars and pylons, the braces, ropes, and wires of the Golden Gate Bridge were slowly filling with birds, thousands of them. Mainly blackbirds and crows, they covered all available surfaces, with more arriving every moment.
They're coming from Alcatraz, Josh said, dipping his head to look across the choppy waters toward the island.
A dark cloud had gathered above Alcatraz. It rose out of the abandoned prison in a dark curl and hung in the air looking like smoke. But this smoke didn't dissipate. It moved and circled in a solid mass.
Birds. Josh swallowed hard. There must be